Hello there, welcome to IASB Update. This is a summary podcast of the taking account the events of the IASB board meeting, which started on Wednesday the 20th of November 2013. With me today I have Stephen Cooper, who's a member of the IASB, Hugh Lloyd, Senior Technical Director of the IASB, and Alan Tashila, also Senior Technical Director of the IASB. Before we begin, just a brief housekeeping note. All views expressed today during this broadcast are those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect those of the IASB. So without further ado, let's begin. Sue, financial instruments, I think, to begin with.
Actually, I was going to start just with a quick mention of revenue recognition, if that's all right, and then I'll move on to FI. So at this week's meeting, we finished the deliberations on revenue recognition in the very formal sense of confirming that the board has completed all the necessary due process steps to enable us to move on to a final IFRS on revenue recognition, and confirmed that no board members intend to dissent on that document. So we move now into drafting phase. Also this week, while we're on the topic of projects that are at completion or near completion, we published some amendments to IFRS 9, which include, importantly, the new hedge accounting chapter in IFRS 9, and also removed the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9 and enable entities to change the way they present gains and losses on own credit before they make any other changes to financial instruments accounting in IFRS 9. So an important set of changes that were published this week. So those are the things near finishing. Now moving to things that are still open on classification and measurement, first of all. So at this week's joint board meeting, the boards discussed the business model criteria in IFRS 9 and confirmed that the basis for determining the business model that would be used to classify financial instruments is based on considering how cash flows are generated and how value is created in different business models, and that's a core thing that we're trying to get to. We had some discussions about the criteria for defining what the hold to collect business model is that would enable simple debt instruments to be measured at amortized cost. We really confirmed what was in our recent exposure draft with a few clarifications. In particular, what we focused on was the role of sales in making the assessment of business model, really to say that the level of sales shouldn't be what determines business model. It's a piece of information, but not the only piece of information that should be considered, and that we wouldn't expect a business model to change period to period just because the level of sales activity were to change. The other specific thing that we talked about on hold to collect was whether or not there should be any sort of special requirements if sales occur in order to address credit concentration issues, and the board decided that the normal criteria should apply. There should be no special requirements in the literature to deal with changes due to credit concentration, which is different for sales due to credit deterioration, where sales, irrespective of volume, are considered to be consistent with the hold to collect business model for credit deterioration. The board's also confirmed that there would be two categories of fair value measurement in IFRS 9, so a fair value through OCI category, which would be a new addition, and confirming the fair value through profit or loss category in IFRS 9. The board's confirmed that fair value through profit or loss should be the residual category, so hold to collect and hold to collect or sell will be the defined categories. So really a set of changes that largely confirmed what was in the exposure draft. Now just commenting on impairment quickly. On impairment, we had quite a few papers, all of which really confirmed, again, proposals that were in our recent impairment exposure draft. So no really fundamental changes to the model except one, I guess, to deal with some off-balance sheet items. In the exposure draft, we'd said that if you're measuring expected credit losses for loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts, revolving facilities, the life that you would consider to measure the expected credit losses should be restricted to the contractual life. And that meant that if you had facilities such as revolving facilities, which from a technical perspective could be withdrawn with a day's notice, you would have a one-day expected life for those instruments when you measure expected credit losses. Lots of people told us that was inconsistent with how expected credit losses are looked at from an economic perspective, and the board was sympathetic to that, particularly for revolving facilities. So this week the board decided that for revolving facilities you can take into account the behavioural life to determine the expected credit losses on revolving facilities. The board also discussed a bit whether we should take a more principles-based approach and focus on all facilities where there was a practical inability to withdraw your credit commitments, irrespective of the legal terms. So the staff were asked to go away and do a bit more work on that, which we will consider at the December meeting. We then confirmed a series of proposals that were in the exposure draft. We confirmed that the financial assets that are measured at fair value through OCI should have the same model used to measure impairment. We confirmed that if an instrument is suffering from incurred losses, that the way that interest is calculated is changed to calculate interest on the basis of the net carrying amount, taking into account the credit allowance, rather than on the gross carrying amount, which is usually the case. And we also confirmed the proposals for the accounting for trade receivables and lease receivables that were in the exposure draft. The other important discussion that the board had on impairment was about the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9. As I said earlier this week, we removed the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9, which used to be the 1st of January 2015. And people have been anxious to know whether that means that the new date will be the 1st of January 2016, because that would mean that for the impairment proposals, people would need to start making systems changes really almost straight away. The board decided that it would be helpful to give a signal to the market on the mandatory effective date, so we didn't make a decision on what the actual date is, but the board did agree to confirm that we would not set a mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 that would be any earlier than the 1st of January 2017, and that was designed to help people with their budgeting and planning processes.
Okay, thank you very much, Sue. Okay, moving on, Stephen, leases.
Yeah, so this is the first meeting the board had to discuss responses to the second exposure draft that we put out on leasing. We've had over 600 comment letters, and the staff have prepared an initial, fairly high-level analysis of the responses. There'll be more detailed analysis on specific topics as and when the board comes to re-deliberate. Now, of course, inevitably with this, there's a wide variety of views, but I think there are some high-level views that I'd quite like to highlight, and that is that the majority of respondents seem to accept that leases create assets and liabilities for the lessee. And this is consistent with what we heard from the first exposure draft, that people do believe that recognition of these assets and liabilities would improve the quality of financial reporting. There was also a lot of support for some of the changes that we've made from the first exposure draft. So changes to how to deal with variable lease payments, changes to the lease term definition used to measure these assets and liabilities, changes to the lease definition and changes to scope. Not everybody supported those, but there was a significant amount of support for many of the changes that the board has made. But of course, there is the key issue of, well, how do you measure and account for these assets and liabilities recognised in the lessee's financial statements? And many will be aware that we, in this recent exposure draft, put forward two alternative approaches, type A and type B accounting, we called them. Type A was consistent with the first exposure draft, type B was more of a straight line lease expense recognition within the lessee's income statement, and we essentially characterize most equipment leases as being type A and most property leases as being type B. Now, many people disagreed with this split between type A and type B, feeling that it wasn't conceptually justified. Some did support it on conceptual grounds, notably some user comment letters very much liked the way in which we had done that split. Some others, however, believe that only type A accounting, the method used in the first exposure draft, is contractually justified, so that's more consistent with how we account for fixed assets and debt-like obligations in other standards. So there were some mixed views on the lessee accounting. Likewise, there were mixed views on the lessor accounting. Some appreciated the symmetry that we had created between lessee and lessor. Others believed that symmetry between lessee and lessor wasn't necessary. Some believed that characterizing the lessor side as being effectively the sale of a right of use and kind of a partial sale of the underlying asset was not appropriate accounting. Some said that they saw no reason why we would want to change lessor accounting on the basis that lessor accounting isn't broken at the moment and that the real focus should be on lessee accounting. So the board has some challenging re-deliberations to go through. We need to look at the feedback in these more difficult areas, particularly of the lessee accounting, in more detail. And over the coming months, the board will be re-deliberating all of these different issues.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Steve. Moving on, Alan. So rate-regulated activities, I think, is next on our discussion.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. We had a discussion today. The two aspects of rate regulation I think are important. First of all, this week we completed our formalities on the interim standard that we're finalising, and the board agreed to go ahead to issue that. So we're moving just as we are with the revenue and the drafting. With the rate regulation, we're also moving to drafting as well. And we expect to have that out as a final standard in Q1 next year. We did have three dissents to that one, so it wasn't quite the unanimous approval of the board. Relatedly, the reason we have an interim standard is that we've got a longer-term project to try and look more broadly at rate-regulated activities. This is particularly where you've got sectors where, such as electricity, for example, where they're controlled or managed and the prices are actually set. And there are some cases where we have things such as what they call the true-up, where an entity that operates within a sector actually has the right to increase prices specifically to recover some costs. And the question we were asked, discussing this week at the board was whether that process itself and the right to increase those prices and to collect that amount actually gave a right to an asset. So it was quite a general discussion because at the moment the board is trying to form its preliminary views with a view to getting a discussion paper out in Q2 of next year. The other thing that was helpful this week is that the general discussion about the nature of rate regulation was helped by some discussions we had last week. We have a consultative group that meets, that's a specialised group for rate regulation, and they met here just in the week before board week, and it was very helpful to get their feedback as that fed into the discussions today. That was a public meeting as well, so if anybody's interested, they can see the papers and recording of that on our website. As I said, we're going ahead. Q2 next year would be the expected publication date for the discussion paper.
Sure. Thanks very much. And post-implementation review?
Our second post-implementation review is a fairly major one on business combinations. By major, I don't want to create any expectation that we're going to that we move immediately to do anything as a result. This is a learning exercise to find out if there are unintended consequences or there are some things that we could do to help those applying the standard or looking at information that comes out of it, or if there's anything we can learn from the way we develop the standard. So it's a general review. The staff have been doing a lot of initial work, essentially getting an initial assessment of what people think of it. So the way I like to describe it is that you're trying to get what people think about the standard, what they think the issues might be. And now our next phase is to be slightly more concrete from that and actually use that sort of preliminary thinking to shape our questions. And we have a public request for information, and that should be out in the first quarter of next year. And it'll ask some issues, for example, such as whether, given that the financial crisis really started to bloom, I believe it's not the right word for a crisis, I suppose, at the same time the standard came out, whether or not that caused any particular difficulties for the way people had to measure items at fair value. We've had a bit of initial feedback that perhaps, for example, that alternative uses for an asset was far more frequent than anybody anticipated at the time. Similarly, you have to impair goodwill under the model. We're not certainly not suggesting we go back on that decision, but are there some aspects of the impairment model that actually people such as the fine aren't working quite so well? And then just another quick one I'll mention is that at the moment, and I mention it because there are a lot of issues that come to our interpretations committee. We have different accounting for a group of assets versus a group of assets that comprises a business. And a lot of the arguments swing around what a business is. But we are going to ask a fundamental question as to whether or not the economics of those two transactions are fundamentally different, and maybe we should just align the accounting. So there's some basic questions we'll ask, and we'll get all this information in. It's a public process. The document will be out next year for about 4 months' comment, and it'll be towards the end of next year before we finalise that.
Thank you very much. I think that's about all for this meeting. Anything you should be looking out for in the next few weeks?
We had the other bits of the meeting which feed into this is we did have some little wrapping up sessions for some narrow scope improvements. There are lots of little bits and pieces coming out. We are very close now to finalising the technical decisions for some amendments to IS1, which is to do with disclosure and trying to make it less prescriptive, I think, in IS1, but we also should be wrapping up our annual improvements. Two packages of those will come out over the next few weeks, and also some narrow scope ones. So I think it's a relatively busy time for us as we head towards the end of the calendar year for us to get wrapping up some of the smaller projects.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Very interesting. We will be back next month, and we will catch you then. Thank you very much.